plate a potential nugget.
The other theme we focus on this podcast, Sukhinder, is about how people make work choices and life choices. In one of the sections of the book, you speak about you use the term negotiations with your husband about having a third child while wanting to be a tech company CEO. I guess asking a broader question, how have you thought about some of your choices around work and your family life, especially around maternity, which I find to be a point of leakage in the pipeline of the women rising to the top. Yeah. So how have you thought about that at various points in time?
Well, I think that maybe the way I've thought about it, that in hindsight, I realize is different than a lot of women or other leaders that I didn't necessarily see, but more so women who actually research shows are more risk averse. Like there is research to support that, you know, that claim. I guess I have never thought of it things as binary, and therein has been my ability to get through. Does that make sense? So I've never thought it's all work, it's all home. If I make a choice for this, it's a choice against this. By the way, there's sacrifices all around. I always say someone is unhappy with me. So that is absolutely true. What is absolutely true is there's no balance. Somebody is always getting disappointed. My family is like, you put so much energy into work. My, you know, people at work might be like, what? You're not available at this time because you're going to your daughter's water polo game. Like, I need more of you. And I'm like, well, there's only so much. So it is true that you get fairly, used to the fact that you're always disappointing someone. And thus there's some guilt there. But that aside, I think the key for me has always been like, don't presume something is impossible unless you first fully negotiate it at home or at work. And so, because when women say it's not possible, and by the way, that doesn't mean you have to want it. Like there are severe trade-offs you make. So I'm not the person to say to women, you have to want it, this lifestyle. No, that's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying if you want it, don't presume it's not possible until you negotiate to the nth degree what is possible. So get it to the best possible state through negotiation, as opposed to saying, I opt out. Because when you opt out without having a conversation, you don't know what's possible. So you may or may not be familiar. When I was at Google, I got married late. So I was 34 when I got married. Not late in today's era, but for an Indian woman, late. But certainly by the time I got married, I was senior at Google. But by the time I was pregnant with my first child, which was 35, I was already, you know, very senior, and I was running APAC and LATAM. And I thought, how can I possibly do this? But I really want to stay in this job. I'm just getting started. So I went to Google and I said, I would like you to pay for my nanny and my daughter to travel with me around the world. This is how I stay in this job. And to their credit, they said yes. They looked at the opportunity cost of losing me. By the way, not an ideal choice. My husband was left at home alone for ages, but better than giving up my job, better than my daughter being at home without me and being a mother who is like absent all the time, right? So he got the shortest end of the stick. We were all gone for weeks at a time. You know, 2 weeks at a time, the house would be empty because my daughter and I and the nanny were gone. But at least we were together as a unit when she was a newborn. But I didn't know that was possible. Like that was something I brainstormed at home and took to work. And then the converse is also true, as we talked about. Like later in my career, I wanted to be a tech CEO. And my husband thought, like, how do we have time for a third child? And we spent a year talking about how to have a third child. Because I also said, you know, not having a third child will be one of the biggest regrets of my lifetime. Like, I can't imagine it. So let's just keep talking it through until we get to a compromise where it's possible. And then we architected the support we would need to make it possible.
And actually, building on that, Sukhinder, I guess a prerequisite for that is some level of self-awareness about what we really want. You know, sometimes as you go through these roles, what's been your approach to get to the bottom of what you really want?
That's a tough one, right? Because sometimes what we want evolves as we go. So we think we know what we want, and then we end up in a situation and are like much happier than we thought or much unhappier than we thought. So like anyone else, I would say I've probably learned self-awareness of who I am earlier than what I want, and what I want has evolved. And I think we learn self-awareness of who we are by asking for feedback. And if not, like, you know, lots of people don't get regular feedback in their jobs, like literally turning to people we know and being sure enough to say, like, you know, you're my best friend. What do you think I'm good at? Like, where do you see me shine if you don't know the answer? So I think that I've had pounded into me as an executive all the things I'm not great at and great at because I've had lots of reviews. So I think that kind of self-awareness is easily more gettable. The kind of like what's at the root of our desires, I don't know, that's been an evolution for me, honestly. And I think it's just been about talking it through. And this thing in the book I really like from one of the stories in the book, Nick Gruden, who runs partnerships at Facebook. And he talked about like, I discovered who I was on the way, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think mm-hmm. I am one of those people. So I don't say I think I've had always known my level of ambition. Mm. I don't think I've always known exactly, you know, what would make me happy. But I think, you know, it's like anything, you know, every time I went through an experience, I learned more about myself. So I think I maybe have spent more time on self-awareness of maybe who I am than what I want, because what I want has kept evolving as I've learned kind of from every experience. So maybe that's not a pat answer, but that's the truth.
So Kinder makes an interesting point here. Step one is about having some self-awareness around who we are and what we really want. The next step is to really negotiate with the people around you to see what's possible. One of my earlier guests in the podcast was Professor Stu Friedman of Wharton, who's been working on work-life integration for several years now. He speaks about the notion of being artfully political when it comes to negotiating with the people around us, and builds on the work of Joel DeLuca, the author of the book Political Savvy.
Joel DeLuca is just really smart guy, and he wrote a wonderful book called Political Savvy, Leadership Behind the Scenes, and I've learned a ton from that book. And so some of these ideas in Total Leadership on the chapter that's about moving your ideas forward in the real world. So after you've done some self-analysis and thinking about and articulating your values, your leadership vision, after you've identified the key people in your life and talked about your mutual expectations and gotten a better understanding of all those social forces swirling about, and you've gotten a clearer picture of what you need to do to better align who you are with what you do and who you surround yourself with and how you serve them, well, then you've got to start to make change. That's the be innovative part, the creativity part. And you mm-hmm. soon learn that there's going to be resistance whenever you try to change something. So when you are trying to make change happen, as DeLuca teaches so well in his wonderful book, you've got to, of course, serve the interests of the people around you. So that means to be artfully political is just that, to know what the real interests of the people around you are, and to do everything you can to adjust your plans. So I have my students, participants, clients, they develop a game plan and a scorecard for a change that they've designed, an experiment that takes place over a month or two in pursuit of a four-way win. And as soon as they try it, they realize, well, this isn't working because I forgot to think about how my boss was going to react, or my colleague, or my client, or my wife, or my kids. And they have a stake in this. So I'm trying to create time and attention for me to, say, take care of myself, maybe go for a bicycle ride with my children on the weekends as a way to connect with them and be healthier and for all the benefits that might come from that. Let me try that. And then you realize, well, you thought you were going to go for a bicycle ride with your daughter on Saturday morning. Turns out she's busy and doesn't want to do that.
She often has a busier calendar than I do.
Exactly. So to be artfully political simply means to be conscious of the interests of other people as you're trying to get them to support you when you're trying to do something new. And that's a big insight for people. For many of the participants, it seems simple and straightforward, but it's a really important one. And the good news in that, of course, is that you can be smarter about what the interests of others are. And that's one of the main insights people take out of this program. And that's why it's really about leadership, creating change, and bringing others along with you as you're doing it.
If this is of interest, you might like my conversation with Stu Friedman of Wharton. And you can find this at the guest section at playtopotential.com.